You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Support for today's show comes from Google Play. Did you know that you can now download and listen to audiobooks on Google Play? That's right. With hands-free listening using Google Assistant or Chromecast, you can enjoy thousands of titles a la carte, no subscription necessary. There's even multi-device integration across the Google ecosystem. And for a limited time, you get $10 off your first one over $10 by visiting g.co/play/kick. That's g.co/play/kick. Find your story with audiobooks on Google Play. With all the stresses of life, it can be easy to lose perspective on what really matters. But Heineken believes that life is about being with friends and opening yourself to new experiences. Because when you live spontaneously and embrace the unexpected, it's a chance to create new stories and connections. You just have to open it. So enjoy a refreshingly cold, full-bodied Heineken Lager today. With its deep golden color, light fruity aroma, mild bitter taste, and a crisp, clean finish. Cheers! And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. NFL season kicks off this Sunday, and just in time, Mark Leibovich, the chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine and number one New York Times best-selling author of This Town, mercilessly probes America's biggest cultural force, pro football, at a moment of peak success and high anxiety in his new book that's causing quite a stir titled Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times. Today, this native Bostonian comes on the podcast to apologize for the famously annoying Patriots fans, discuss the Patriots superfan in the White House, Trump's weird obsession with Tom Brady, and how the president's support for the team has divided football fans. He offers an unprecedented glimpse into the one club that Donald Trump desperately wanted to join but never could, the exclusive group of 32 billionaires who own NFL teams, or as they like to call themselves, the membership. He says Patriots owner Robert Kraft whines about not getting enough credit for his team's success, talks about the comments in his book that have Kraft in hot water with fans in Boston, and of course, we talk about the rivalry between Kraft and Cowboys owner Jerry Jones. Mark recalls going head-to-head with Jones in a drinking contest aboard the Cowboys bus and losing. He discusses football fans' hatred of Roger Goodell and his astronomical salary and why the membership still protects the much-maligned NFL commish. He reveals just how worried the owners were about the national anthem controversy, how it shined a light on the startling racial disparities in pro football. Plus, we talk about Deflategate, Super Bowl excess, concussions, and other problems plaguing the sport, and ask the question, has America reached peak football? All that and more coming up with Mark Leibovich in just a moment. Mark Leibovich is the chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. He is the recipient of the National Magazine Award for Profile Writing and the author of three books, including the number one New York Times bestseller, This Town, which mercilessly probed the political culture of 21st century Washington, D.C. Now he takes on football in his latest book, Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times. Mark Leibovich, welcome to the podcast.
Good to be with you, Ben.
Well, at first blush, this seems like a bit of a departure for you. You usually cover politics, although there certainly is a good deal of politics that somehow weasels its way into this book.
Yes.
I guess, are you a football fan? Well, I guess you're from Boston, so you must be a Patriots fan, right?
Yeah, I'm unfortunately a big Patriots fan, and I, you know, I come clean immediately. I mean, I hope everyone listening to this doesn't hate me immediately after saying that and making that confession. But yep, I grew up right in the Boston suburbs. Love the New England teams, love the Patriots. Not unaware of the reasons people hate us. But my day job, I haven't lived up there in a while. I live in Washington, D.C. I cover national politics. And look, I just sort of love football and wanted sort of a respite from politics. So I sort of jumped in for a few years and figured I would embed myself with a bunch of owners and players and just people around the league. And as it turned out, it was pretty clear to me immediately that politics, there was no escaping politics in the NFL, either league politics and the sort of Kremlinology that goes on in league meetings and between owners and within teams and so forth. But also, obviously, Donald Trump politics. I mean, Donald Trump has a way of belly-flopping his way into even the most, you know, otherwise contained pool and sort of put himself in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a very political moment in the league, and it seems as polarized now as much of the rest of the country is.
Now, you sort of hinted at this a moment ago, but we all know that Patriots fans can be pretty extreme. You're not one of the annoying fans, are you?
I'm one of the good ones. Trust me, there are a few of us.
Okay.
No, I realize, look, I'm fully aware of what we've become. I think, you know, the sort of the obnoxious answer is, well, you know, everyone's just jealous because we win a lot. But I realize that, you know, no one wants to hear how difficult it is to be a Patriots fan. Mm-hmm. But we do lead the league in crosses to bear. We lead the league in, you know, we have a lot to explain. So at least keeps it interesting.
Well, speaking of annoying Patriots fans, Donald Trump, of course, fawns over the Patriots in a way that no president probably has ever over any team.
Yeah.
You interviewed him and he talked at length about his fandom. Do you think he's a sincere fan in the way that regular football fans are? Or is there something about the Patriots that maybe speaks to his sense of self or his vision of America?
Oh, great question. I mean, I don't think he's a real fan. I don't think he could name he could probably name Tom Brady, maybe Rob Gronkowski. I don't think he could name many other players. Donald Trump loves to be associated with winners, whether he grew up rooting for them or has any sort of loyal ties to them or not. And look, like a lot of famous people, he and they work in an orbit together. I mean, Robert Kraft, the billionaire owner, sort of they've done business together, so they know each other. Tom Brady, I guess, hosted one of his or judged one of his beauty pageant pageants like in 2002 or something. So they became golfing buddies. I don't know how these people get to know each other, but I think that's sort of the extent of his fandom. He doesn't drop their names as much anymore, partly because they're not the defending Super Bowl champions, but I think Brady's been pretty uncomfortable with the association. And I don't know. I just, he's moved on to other things, and he's moved on to attacking the league. So that's sort of his way of getting in the middle of all this.
Yeah, it's interesting how Tom Brady has sort of tried to distance himself from Donald Trump. He almost seems like a friend who's a little bit creeped out by someone who thinks that they're closer friends than they are. You talk about how you interviewed him during the campaign, and all he wanted to talk about was his supposed friendship with Tom Brady. Is Donald Trump a little bit obsessed?
Oh, I think he's just a fanboy. I mean, look, Donald Trump, even in his presidency, I mean, he wants to be accepted by other famous people. I mean, he is the ultimate, you know, in the NFL sense. I mean, he's been trying to buy into the NFL for four decades, and the NFL represents to him the ultimate club that he could not become a member of. And, you know, I don't know what it says about the value system of our country today, but the consolation prize, it turned out, was a trip to the White House, right? Couldn't get into that club, so he can become a heckler from the bully pulpit. Tom Brady, I mean, look, it is a bit of a problematic dynamic for the New England brand as it is. I mean, Trump lost all six states except for a congressional district in the northern tip of Maine, you know, very liberal area of the country. Tom Brady is, you know, from a very liberal Bay Area family. A lot of his friends are Democrats. And like Robert Kraft, same thing. I mean, he's been giving to Democratic causes over the years. He has a lot of high-level friends who don't approve of him palling around with Donald Trump. So you do have everyone becomes a politician. You have to be diplomatic, and you say different things in public than you might in private.
Yeah, and thanks to Trump's super fandom, the Patriots have sort of become a polarizing force among football fans. Yeah. They've become, I guess, the super villain if you're a fan on the left, and if you're a Trump supporter, perhaps with no geographic or traditional allegiance to the Patriots, suddenly you have a new favorite team, huh?
Yeah, it's really unpleasant. I mean, first of all, as a Patriots fan, I mean, I've been apologizing for them, you know, up and down for several years. I mean, whether cheating scandals or Aaron Hernandez or sort of the whiny behavior of the owner or the sort of antisocial behavior of the coach at the podium or Tom Brady's sort of pretty boy tendencies. I mean, there's a lot, like I said, we sort of do lead the league in crosses to bear. And then Trump comes along and there's a big, you know, section of the book in which I look at Super Bowl 51, in which the Patriots are playing Atlanta. This was at the beginning of Trump's presidency. And you realize immediately, I mean, you show up at day one of the Super Bowl on that Monday night when everyone sort of, they do this big media, cluster bomb and everyone shows up and it's just all politics. And the Patriots were the Make America Great Again team. And, you know, America was so tired of winning, we became sick of the Patriots. I mean, that's sort of what Trump wanted you to think. And meanwhile, Atlanta, you know, they have an extraordinarily high African-American season ticket base, I mean, about 40%, which is, I think, if isn't the league high, it's got to be up there. They were the rise up team. That was their slogan. And so you could sort of see it play out in social media. I mean, that became a proxy battle for our ongoing national divorce, whereas people used to look to football as just the great escape from all that.
Yeah, and you talked about the racial disparity within football. It seems like the whole controversy around the national anthem sort of highlighted a lot of racial and political tensions within football that have existed beneath the surface of the NFL itself for a long time, I guess. I was particularly floored by just the raw numbers when it comes to race and political affiliation of the fans, the owners, and the players. You say, I think, 83% of fans are white while 70% of players are black, and of course all the owners are white.
Yep. Shad Khan, who is the owner of the Jacksonville Jaguars, is from Pakistan.
Right.
He's Muslim, but you know, he's been in America for many, many years. But no, I mean this is not a diverse club by any stretch.
And you talk at length about Colin Kaepernick and the whole national anthem controversy. When that happened, I thought for sure, you know, when Trump started tweeting at football players and team owners, that his base was just going to break with him on that. Surely they're football fans first and Trump supporters second, but it doesn't seem to have dented Trump one bit. How about the owners? How badly were they rattled by all the protests and boycotts?
Well, they were rattled because they don't, I mean, first of all, the NFL owners is a group of 32 people that, I mean, are arguably, you know, 32 of the most powerful entertainment executives in America, right? I mean, the NFL's got to be a, you know, top two or three, you know, largest entertainment company in America. These are not the people you would pick to be on a corporate board of a elite entertainment company like Disney or Apple or Fox or something. No, you would not. I mean, this is a pretty kind of motley crew of people who are inherited teams, who kind of lucked into teams, who can't go out in public because they're so either scorned or just too antisocial. I mean, this is a really colorful and not in a really good way group. They are flipped out. I mean, there's a chapter in the book in which we obtained, my colleague Ken Belson and I at the Times, we obtained a taping of a private meeting between a bunch of owners and players at the height of the anthem meeting, and one of our sources was nice enough to run a tape and share it with us. And you just get a sense of just the owners not knowing what to do with Trump. Just how do we prevent Donald from piping up again? Because he hurts us so much. And, you know, how do we control this toddler who is so capricious and so temperamental, you just can't predict him? And you get a sense of, even though Donald Trump might not be allowed in their exclusive club, he certainly now resides in their heads. And I think that probably gives Donald Trump a level of satisfaction, in I guess his view of the world.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I would say that many of them are sort of cut from the same cloth as Donald Trump.
Totally.
And you get unprecedented access into this very exclusive club of 32 billionaires who control the NFL.
Yeah.
Talk to us about that club, or as they like to call themselves, I think, the members
membership.
Or the membership.
Yes, very mob, right? Yeah, no, they... I don't know why. I mean, a lot of them just let me in. I mean, they let me in repeatedly. I mean, I talked to Roger Goodell, you know, three times. I talked to, you know, Kraft three or four times. I talked to, Jerry Jones. I mean, I access to my surprise, wasn't a problem. And I was surprised because, you know, I'm not an NFL insider. I'm not a sports writer. I don't know these people. I don't have history with these people. So I was pleasantly surprised. I guess one of the reasons, and now that the book is out, there's been a lot of fallout, and I was saying to you off air, I mean, there's just been a little sort of kerfuffle in every NFL city about something that owner X or coach Y said in chapter 6 or 7, whatever it is. It's you do get a sense that these people are used to a certain amount of deference, and one of the things you learn when you go to work for the league or go to work for a club, or they call themselves clubs, they're not teams. Is, you know, the owner must be addressed as Mr. So-and-so. You know, do you not dare utter their first name. It's like, you know, Zeus must not be looked at or approached alone. And it's just a bizarre kind of regal sort of American royalty, you know, for people who just have, first of all, absolutely no standing to, like, expect that, except that they do. I mean, these are the kings, and that sort of, I've said, you know, to a couple people, I mean, I think this game will survive because I think it's a great game and I think people love football, but I think it'll survive despite the people who own and run it. And that's sort of what this book is about. I mean, in Big Game, I try to just sort of get into that world and give people a sense of what this bonfire of the vanities look like beyond what you might see on the field.
Yeah, it's an interesting group of men. I think you say in the book that covering the NFL is a lot like covering the Senate. How so? Yeah.
Well, I mean, look, it's a lot of old, rich, predominantly men, you know, used to sort of running an empire of their own. They think they run the world, and, you know, they run a Senate office. They represent a state. They're used to a certain amount of stature. And you know, the key difference is senators have to run for re-election every 6 years. I mean, a guy like Dan Snyder, who probably wouldn't, the owner of the Washington Redskins, probably wouldn't get 10% of the vote if he had to run for re-election in Maryland, Virginia, or the District of Columbia. So I think...
And he's the one thing that Democrats and Republicans in D.C. can actually agree on. They all hate
him. They all
hate him,
right? Yes. He is a point of bipartisan, you know, bipartisan agreement.
You know, it's no surprise that Donald Trump desperately wanted to join their ranks. Prior to his getting elected president, how did the members view him, these real billionaires? How did they view Trump? Did they see him as a bit of a wannabe or a pretender?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that goes back to Pete Rozelle when he was the commissioner of the NFL back in the 70s. I mean, they a lot of them, you know, just saw him as a clown, didn't see him as a serious person, and they didn't even, I mean, he was, I guess, a finalist to own the Buffalo Bills in 2014. But not only was he outbid, but I mean, apparently he was, I wouldn't say laughed out of the room, but I think his name drew, quite a few eye rolls, snickers or worse, you know, among, you know, the members when that came up. But I mean, like Robert Kraft, like Jerry Jones, I mean, the, you know, big public people who are image conscious and who like being in the company of other people that they sort of see in their own image, he's out there a lot. And Robert Kraft used to, like, brandish Donald Trump's friendship and have him at games, and Jerry Jones, same thing. So, you know, celebrity finds celebrity. So there's certainly that kind of history, and I don't think any of them thought he was going to be president, but he is, and now he's a whole other set. He represents a whole other problem for them.
I wonder, did the owners perhaps hold the New Jersey Generals against him? I mean, he a lot of people would say that he kind of destroyed the USFL back in the
Absolutely.
Day. Well, maybe they appreciate that. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he certainly, his decision to, and you know, it was his insistence that they go to a fall schedule so it can compete directly with the NFL rather than the spring schedule, was probably more responsible for sinking the league than any other one decision. Yeah, I mean, that certainly didn't endear him to the league early on, but I think, you know, he's done plenty in his public life and also in his efforts to get into the league that has given, you know, the league plenty of, you know, recent, examples or recent fodder not to let him in. That and the fact that, you know, who knows what his books look like. I don't know
yeah.
the degree to which he ever opened his books for the people that, you know, would make these decisions, but I would say that the NFL Finance Committee and NFL owners, do vet a candidate's finances a lot more closely, as it turned out, than electorates do, because you know, presumably they would want to see his tax returns. Presumably they would want to see, you know, about how financially solvent he is, because, I mean, it's not a club for someone of precarious financial, you know, situation, who has a precarious financial situation. So I don't know. I do think that they've had no shortage of material, though, to doubt him over the years.
Now, a moment ago, you mentioned how every town with a team right now seems to have their own little scandal brewing around whatever the owner in their town
yes,
said
it's awesome.
In your book.
Yeah.
One in particular stands out. You talk about Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, giving an interview to you that I think was supposedly off the record, but you had a tape recorder going, and he starts going off about how much he loves New York, and he has a place there, and he's there all the time, and how it's so much better than Boston, and Boston is just a village.
Boston is
how
a village.
Have the fans
yeah.
reacted to that?
Well, first of all, I mean, it was on the record. I mean, it was like what happened was we were, it was an on the record interview. We were, I was talking to him for a story or a magazine story I did on Brady a couple of years ago. So we were just sort of shooting the breeze at the beginning. But my tape recorder was on and it was in full view on the desk. And apparently, you know, we were talking about, you know, non-Tom Brady things. And he was telling me how much he loved the New York Times, where I work, and he was talking about how he has a place in New York, and he went to Columbia, and he's given money to Columbia, this and that. And he says, New York is just so great, and, you know, Boston's a village compared to New York. And then Stacey James, the vice president of public relations, was sitting next to me on my side of the desk, and he piped up, said, can we take that off the record? So he tried to, after the fact, take that off the record. And at that moment, I agreed because I said, well, I'm writing this magazine piece about Brady, so that's not really on point. So, yeah, I'll agree to take it off the record. And, you know, I didn't say anything about not putting in a book one day. So I think I was on the right side of the ground rules there, so I don't have any problem with that. But, I mean, I don't know how it's gone over. I mean, Boston, I mean, it is a village compared to New York. I say that as someone who grew up there and who's incredibly fond of the place and is very loyal to the place and probably would rather live there than New York. But I also love New York, and I'm there all the time. And I am not unaware that residents of places like Boston or Philadelphia or even Washington, where I live, do have a bit of a little sibling complex when it comes to New York. So there's going to be some exposure there. And I think Stacey James, the PR guy, was aware of this, and which is why he tried to jump on the grenade. And I guess it worked temporarily.
Yeah, I almost wonder if part of that was just him trying to ingratiate himself with you. And, you know, there is sort of, much like D.C., this kind of you'll take care of me and I'll take care of you thing going on.
Very much so. Yeah, very much so. Now, it's a very clubby environment. I mean, when I wrote This Town a few years ago, which is essentially the exact same book, it's just about Washington, D.C., instead of the NFL. I mean, it's just, I'm juxtaposing, or I'm just sort of, I've moved from one sort of embattled empire to another embattled empire in America. And, but you do have the same sense in both places that everyone's part of the same deal. We're all part of the club of politicians and staff people and lobbyists and journalists and, you know, in football, it's owners and players and fans, and not so much fans, but media people, league office people, a commissioner. I mean, you do get a sense of a swamp very easily, and there was a lot that was familiar about both worlds that I saw immediately when I sort of dipped into the NFL.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Mark Leibovich when we come back in just a minute. Today's podcast was sponsored by Espresso Monster. That's right. Now the guys behind Monster Energy have a delicious espresso drink for when you need an extra burst of energy but don't have time to wait in line at a coffee joint. Espresso Monster is a premium blend of smooth espresso and cream packaged in an 8.4-ounce can. It's just the right size and perfect for when you're on the go. Each can has 3 shots of espresso blended with European milk just the way the Italians do. At 150 to 160 milligrams of caffeine per can, it's sure to give you the energy you need to conquer the day. Espresso Monster has 2 delicious flavors to choose from, espresso and cream, and vanilla espresso. That one's my favorite. Man, it is tasty. Produced in Denmark and the Netherlands, Espresso Monster is made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend that's complete with taurine and B vitamins. In fact, I had one just before taping this podcast. You know how sluggish you feel around 1 or 2 o'clock after lunch? Me too. And when I'm tired, I can't get anything done. But I had a yummy vanilla espresso monster after lunch, and it gave me just the jolt I needed to power through the rest of my day. Try it for yourself. Close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. If you're enjoying today's interview with Mark Leibovich, then you obviously love football, and of course you love a good podcast, so I've got a great recommendation for you. If you want to hear your favorite players and analysts break things down on and off the field, don't miss the Dave Damashek Football Program. A veteran in the sports media game, Dave Damashek has impeccable knowledge of the NFL and a signature lighthearted rapport with his guests, many of whom happen to be the biggest names in the league. Damashek and his guests operate on a strict no-jive policy, only honest, unfiltered opinions allowed. What's it really like in the huddle? Who are the best trash talkers in the league? Who's the best cornerback Antonio Brown has ever faced? From Cam Jordan's favorite Will Ferrell movies to Dak Prescott's take on the most handsome NFL quarterbacks, the Dave Damashek Football Program tackles the game of football and the game called life. As the NFL preseason unfolds, tune in to the Dave Damashek Football Program for some bold predictions, quarterback rankings, and hot takes on the latest news stories ahead of kickoff 2018. Subscribe to the Dave Damashek Football Program, available twice a week. Listen now on your favorite podcast app or NFL.com. And now, back to the podcast. And when you sat down with Kraft, you seemed to pick up on some jealousy of Brady and Belichick. Does he think that he hasn't got enough credit for the team's success?
Yeah, I mean, Robert's pretty needy in some ways. I mean, he's people think, you know, the Patriots have done well because of Tom Brady and Bill Belichick. I mean, in the same way that the 49ers did well because of Bill Walsh and Joe Montana, and the Steelers because of Chuck Knoll and Terry Bradshaw. I mean, it's like that's sort of how people look at dynasties. But yeah, I mean, Kraft believes that he should be given, you know, equal billing, and the PR, you know, people for the Patriots work for him, and I don't think Belichick really cares about how he's perceived, and Brady sort of has figured out that, you know, through social media or just his own sort of friendly outlets, I mean, he can tell his story in his way. So, no, I mean, Robert Kraft I think, he loves the attention. He wants to be famous, and he wants to be sort of seen as a serious football guru. And obviously, he deserves a great deal of credit, and he hired Bill Belichick. And I'm, as a Bostonian, grateful to him for saving the team from moving in 1994 when the people were threatening to take them to St. Louis. I'm not without, you know, fondness for him because he's a very familiar figure. I knew people like him when I was growing up. A lot of my friends' dads were like him. I think he's a small-town guy who wants the affection of the big boys. He's always talking about how much he loves New York, and he spends a lot of time there and a lot of time in L.A. And, I think sometimes he just gets bored in what he would call the village, and that's fine, but I don't know. It's unclear. I mean, I don't know what's in his mind, but it's clear that he's the most needy of the three.
Well, to the extent that he's a little bit needy and insecure about his status within the league, he's half of probably, I guess, the biggest rivalry in the NFL, him and Jerry Jones. Do you think that's a rivalry of equals, or is that more of a rivalry that exists in Kraft's head?
I think it's a rivalry that most people don't care about, to be honest with you. I mean, I do think they keep an eye on it. They're watching each other. I mean, it's important to both of them to be seen as first among equals in the membership. And, this little mess that's brewing in Dallas, thanks to the book, is at one point, I mean, so Robert Kraft had, he's got 5 Super Bowl rings, and Jerry's got 3 Super Bowl rings, but he just got his gold jacket to go into the Hall of Fame, and that's something that Robert has coveted for many years. And I asked Jerry when I was with him, would you trade your gold jacket for another Super Bowl ring? And look, if you're an NFL owner and you're in a football-hungry market like Dallas, and you got a PR guy sitting next to him, which he did, there's one politic answer to that question, which is, I'll take the ring. There's nothing more important than getting the Dallas Cowboys back to the Super Bowl and winning the Super Bowl. And that is what drives us. That is what I think about every day, and all of that. And Jerry, I don't know why, and in fairness, we'd been drinking, especially him, said, he hemmed and hawed and finally said, no, I'm not trading my gold jacket for another ring. And I guess he was refreshingly honest, but his PR guy immediately tried to, like, appeal to me to like give him a mulligan on that. We happened to be on a bus outside a golf tournament, and he said, "Well, we're on a golf course, so let's get a mulligan." I agreed. I did not agree to do that, and you know, I guess he's now dealing with the fallout around Dallas. I haven't checked the Dallas Morning News website or Cowboys.com or anything, but I'm sure he's got some way to explain it.
Yeah, and in fairness, you guys were doing shots of whiskey on the Cowboys bus.
Yes.
Could you keep up with them?
No, I completely embarrassed myself and my family. That guy's like, he's got, his liver belongs in Canton, Ohio, I'll say that. The Cowboys bus is not for the faint of heart or liver. The guy loves his Johnny Walker Blue, and he's a heavyweight drinker, and I mean, maybe a middleweight at best, somewhere light to middleweight. Maybe I was a middleweight in college. But when he said, "You want a shot of scotch," I figured a shot of scotch. But I guess a shot in Jerry's world is a 24-ounce Dallas Cowboys souvenir plastic cup that you get at the stadium filled with ice and Johnny Walker Blue. And, 4 hours later, and luckily, my tape recorder was working perfectly and was not drinking. was left to sort of sleep off my interview on the bench of the Dallas Cowboys bus while Jerry went back into the clubhouse and immediately ordered up some beers and started lighting up some cigars, as he said. So, I can't keep up with the Joneses.
I want to briefly touch on NFL Commissioner Robert Goodell. No one likes that guy, so how the hell is he still around?
He's very good at one aspect of his job. Mm-hmm. I mean, Roger is someone who, his job is to keep 32 very, very insecure, very, very rich guys happy. I mean, he runs a trade association. This league is a private corporation owned by 32 people, and Roger works for them, except when he is punishing them and, suspending their players and hurting their reputations. I mean, it's a bizarre dynamic. But look, I mean, Roger Goodell has a sheet on his desk in which all 32 NFL owners are listed, and he has a date on when he last talked to them. And he knows exactly when he needs to sort of call up Martha Ford, the 92-year-old matriarch of the Detroit Lions, and make nice to her because maybe he hasn't talked to her in a few weeks. He knows what Jimmy Haslam, the owner of the Cleveland Browns, is concerned about as far as some new tax that the Browns are lobbying for in the Ohio legislature. I mean, he's very attentive to these needs. And look, I mean, these 32 people decide whether he continues or not, and they just signed him to a 5-year contract that could be worth about $200 million. So he doesn't have to worry about anything, just like these guys don't have anything to worry about. So, that's why he sticks around. I mean, beyond that, he's certainly not good for the brand, and I don't know why the league allows it to continue for him to be booed through, 7 rounds of the draft. I mean, year after year, night after night. He's got a real gift for self-inflicting, things and making things a lot worse than they need to be. And yet somehow he survives because he does the two most important things, which are keep the owners happy and also make them a ton of money.
Well, he got his dream job. It was kind of strange because in your interview, he talks about as a kid, he dreamt of being Pete Rozelle, not a player, not a coach,
right,
but being the head of the league.
Yes.
That was his big dream.
Very weird, right? Yes. You would think that, he grew up, around Washington, actually. I mean, you think that, and he liked the Colts. So, you'd think that he'd want to be Johnny Unitas, right?
Yeah. Or,
someone like that, Raymond Berry, someone like that. But no, he wanted to be the commissioner. I mean, I don't think I've ever known a kid, it certainly wasn't me, who grew up wanting to be the commissioner. So it's bizarre. So I guess he got what he wanted.
Yeah, fans love to complain about this astronomic salary that he gets. And you also talk about just how the game has changed in general and the bloated spectacle that is the modern Super Bowl as another example of the kind of excess that overshadows what really matters. Do you think that it's becoming too much about all the bullshit and not enough about the game these days?
I think so. I mean, look, I mean, if I weren't writing a book on it, I certainly would have tuned it out, and I certainly wouldn't have, I probably wouldn't have gone to Minneapolis in the middle of the winter this year to go to the Super Bowl either. But no, I mean, it's spectacle, it's carnival, it's something, it's just people that you, it's just so much that has nothing to do with football and sponsorships and it's just the NFL finding any number of different ways to print money and to take care of its sort of heavy-hitting clients and customers and sponsors and so forth. But yeah, I mean, look, there's a huge carnival aspect to football. You know, the thing that saves it in the end is that the game starts. And, you know, as we've seen the last few Super Bowls, we've been fortunate enough, the game's been great. The game is the best thing football has going for it is football. I think the worst thing football has going for it is a lot of the bullshit, as you said, around it. And, I don't pretend to like it. And I don't know. I think at some point, you know, maybe it reaches a shelf life and people will get sick of it also.
Well, speaking of the bullshit, the way the media hyped Deflategate, you would think that it was a sports scandal on par with the 1919 Black Sox. do you think in retrospect that was pretty overblown?
Yeah, I thought it at the time, too. I mean, I think, and by the way, you mentioned the Black Sox. I mean, this was like literally an analogy that the lawyers, you know, in writing some brief, you know, about why Tom Brady was the most crooked athlete in history. I mean, that literally was an analogy that they used. It was bizarre. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you cannot convince me that this was not like driving 56 in a 55-mile-an-hour zone. You know, it's a minor equipment violation at best, I think. And I think, you know, no worse than what any other, you know, NFL team, if you looked at, you know, their phone records and their texts and everything and just interviewed a million different people and spent $20 million on an investigation, that you would find. So, look, I think it was nonsense. I also think it was a very invented reality show that was probably good for Roger Goodell because a lot of the other owners and coaches wanted to stick it to the Patriots, and non-Patriots fans love Patriots fans to be upset. So, you have, like you have in the rest of America, you have the New England, you know, political party here who was absolutely all in on the, you know, this is the most corrupt, rigged system ever, and then the rest of the league who's allegiances sort of skew accordingly. So, but, you know, look, I mean, you could argue, and it's been argued, or, you know, I don't have proof for this, but the league sort of welcomed a distraction like this because it's better to talk about this sort of goofy story that just kept going and going and going rather than domestic violence. I mean, the previous year was dominated by Ray Rice.
Interesting.
You know, it's a much more fun topic to talk about, you know, football, you know, air pressure than it is, say, concussions or something. So, you know, it was sort of a light snack after the heavy indigestion of some of these other issues.
And you've talked to Tom Brady many times over the years. You've kind of had an ongoing conversation. I think, in fact, you talked to him during this whole scandal.
Yeah.
How did he process all of this?
Tom Brady is, he's not like you or me. I mean, he is someone who has an incredible ability just to stay focused and to compartmentalize and to be very, very disciplined, both as a football player and as, you know, as a physical specimen, but also as a public figure. But I mean, Tom can be very, very candid and very, very thoughtful. But he, he thought that this thing was as unfair as I think a lot of people did. And I mean, there's just a lot of just really, really weird stuff that went into the NFL, just spending so many resources to vilify arguably its most, famous player. For something completely uncriminal and completely just negligible at all. But he managed to, he focused. I mean, he has a level of discipline that I could never hope for, or I could only hope for and that I could never even imagine. But no, it wounded him. I mean, he felt very betrayed by the league, I think by Robert Kraft, I think by, people who sort of dined him out around the league. And I think, you know, he wears those scars, and in some ways it sort of drives him.
Yeah, I think you say that he even considered at one point just giving up and retiring during Deflategate. How close do you think he came?
He did. He talked about it with some friends. He's like, you know, screw this. I don't need this. I mean, like, I'm 38 years old. I've won 4 Super Bowls. I mean, this is not, you know, it's just not worth it. It's unclear to me whether he ever really, like, sat down and sort of, you know, sat with this decision, or whether this was just sort of a moment of frustration in which he had a particularly bad day or a bad ruling or read a bad article and just like sort of threw his hands up and said a few things, and that got around and got to me. But no, I mean, he talks like that. I mean, it's just, I think, like anyone, he'll sometimes think out loud but it's clear, I mean, from what he's done the last few years, that he doesn't have any, I mean, he'd love to keep playing if he can. So I think that bullet was dodged.
And on an even more serious level, the one controversy that's perhaps in some people's mind represented an existential threat to football is this plague of player concussions that brings to light something, frankly, that I always assumed when I was playing football in junior high, which is, you know, you hurdle yourself at another human being so many times, you're probably going to get hurt.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, I was probably the most useless linebacker you ever saw because I never wanted to block anyone.
Right.
I just wanted to stay the hell out of the way. I was all about self-preservation. I mean, let's be honest, football players don't age well.
they don't age well. I mean, look, the numbers are what they are, and there's no shortage of sort of like very, very gruesome testimonials from players about this, retired players about the state of their bodies, not to mention science about dead players and what their brains look like. So, I mean, the data is definitely piling up. I mean, I think, but I also think that, look, I mean, it is buyer beware. I think people at this point do know what they're getting into. I mean, it is definitely a risk. But, you know, no one is forcing people to play football and no one's forcing people to watch football. I mean, I think if the data reaches even more critical mass, that might change. But look, I mean, it's a game that people love, and at this point, it doesn't. I mean, yeah, it's hurting youth participation. I think it creates a moral dilemma for a lot of people who allow themselves to think about this. And I must admit, I do sometimes. But you know, usually, just sort of the yearning for escape and fandom, and just football wins out. But you know, whether that will continue is unclear, but I mean, right now there are no indications that this will make any, this is making any short-term dent in certainly revenues and popularity of the game. And frankly, the entertainment that, you know, you get when you watch a great Super Bowl like we did last year.
Well, yeah, and I don't know what the answer would be. I mean, how do you address player safety without making the game boring?
Well, they're struggling with that. I mean, I guess to the league's credit, they're trying to do something. I mean, they have this new helmet rule or this new tackling rule, which looks like, you know, in reality could be a real mess because I don't think officials really know what the rule is yet and hasn't really been worked out with the players. So it's very much a work in progress. But they are trying. I mean, I will say that. I don't think football is going to be a game that's safe at any speed. And I think you see the numbers of concussions either rising or staying roughly the same. So, I mean, I think that might change things at the margins, but look, it's a violent game and you can't change that. And, you know, you might be able to improve equipment. You might be able to tweak tackling techniques and so forth. But I think ultimately you're dealing with a level of risk and a level of sort of moral consideration that everyone sort of has to make or someone has to engage in themselves. And, I don't know what the answer to it is, except that it doesn't seem to be showing up in any sort of big numbers.
Okay. Well, yeah, because all of this sort of begs the question, how much have all the scandals and the excess impacted the NFL's brand? And I think this is what you try to get to at the end of your book. Have we reached peak football?
You know, I think we might. We might have. I mean, look, the NFL is a very nervous empire. I mean, there's just not a lot of room to grow, right? I mean, it's not like people in China are rushing out to buy football equipment. It's not like, I mean, yeah, they're trying. I mean, they try to market themselves in China. And, you know, there's talk that they might sort of amp things up in Great Britain and Mexico. And, you know, but there is a pretty finite sort of global growth that the NFL can do that say basketball doesn't, you know, isn't inhibited by. And also, you know, the fact that entertainment is being disseminated so much differently. I mean, the TV monopoly is pretty much over and cord cutting and so forth. And look, I think the tastes of this generation of athlete and fan and just sort of citizens in general might skew away towards the kind of Donald Trump-like sensibility that sort of is in line with football. I mean, this is, soccer's growing in popularity. The NBA is, you know, is having a great few years. And I have to say, as a Boston Celtics fan, I love the NBA now. I mean, I've enjoyed watching the NBA, not just the Celtics, but there's like 8 or 9 teams that I will watch no matter what these days, like last season, especially during the playoffs. It was a blast. And I do think that the NBA is in a much better sort of cultural place as far as where the growth is, where the global growth is, and where the culture might be going than the NFL is. So I don't think the league's unaware of that. I don't think the NFL is unaware of that. And I also don't think that they have the most sort of forward-looking and innovative people in charge to sort of look around the corners that you might need when you're trying to grow a business that's that complex.
What about for you as a fan personally? Do you still have that love of the game, or did seeing how the sausage get made dampen your enthusiasm a little bit?
You know, we talk to me in a few months. Okay. I mean, I honestly, it did dampen my enthusiasm, and I'm sick of a lot of these people. I'm sick of, you know, how the Anthem thing's been handled. I think, you know, Goodell sort of kind of rode that thing out last year. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Trump's going to pipe up. It's going to be a very loud season. There's going to be a lot of discord. I don't think the players are terribly happy with the way this is going. You know, there's a lot of, I mean, as a Patriots fan, it's a sort of tired, I mean, there's a lot of tension between the key players, and, you know, Brady might be unhappy and he might be, you know, playing out his contract, and Belichick, and it's so there's that. I mean, I'm pretty sure that if there were a game tonight, I'd probably turn it on and watch it. I mean, I haven't like chosen the hill to die on where I'm going to say I am not watching the game tonight because these new concussion numbers are a bridge too far for me. I mean, I'm not, you know, maybe when I become a, you know, maybe I'll get to that point, but I'm just not there yet. And I love to watch a good football game. And if it's Thursday night and there's a decent game on TV, there's a really good chance that I'm going to be happy that it's on. I'm going to watch it.
Well, before we go, I do want to ask you one straight-up political question. Your last book, This Town, which was a number one bestseller, explored the swampiness of Washington, D.C. in this century. Trump said, of course, that he was going to drain that swamp. Now, this may be a rhetorical question, but from what you can see, and Trump's own corruption and his family aside, from what you can see of the culture in D.C., has it gotten any better or worse?
Oh, are you kidding? No, the swamp has not been drained. It's more like a hot tub. It's like a gold plated hot tub. I mean, you walk around here, and I live here. It's like, you know, no one's starving here. I mean, lobbyists are doing great, and consultants are doing great, and the revolving door between, you know, government and the private sector and corporations. I mean, it's alive and well. No, I mean, he hasn't drained the swamp at all. I mean, you could argue that he has animated it in his own sort of particular Trumpian way, and no, so that hasn't happened.
Okay. Like I said, I kind of figured that was a rhetorical question.
Oh yeah. No, it's beautiful in the swamp.
Okay. Well, once again, the book is called Big Game: The NFL in Dangerous Times. Mark Leibovich, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for talking with me.
Thanks for having me, Ben. I enjoyed it.
Thanks again to Mark Leibovich for coming on the podcast. One more time, get his book, Big Game: The NFL in Dangerous Times, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. And keep up with him at markleibovich.com or on Twitter at @markleibovich. Today's podcast was brought to you by Espresso Monster. When you need energy on the go and don't have time to wait in line, grab Espresso Monster. Espresso Monster is a premium blend of espresso and cream made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend complete with taurine and B vitamins. Each can has 3 shots of espresso and comes in vanilla espresso or espresso and cream. I wouldn't even be recording this podcast right now if I hadn't had a vanilla Espresso Monster after lunch today. It's delicious, and it was just the jolt I needed. Try for yourself, folks. Close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. Support for today's show comes from Google Play. Did you know that you can now download and listen to audiobooks on Google Play? That's right. With hands-free listening using Google Assistant or Chromecast, you can enjoy thousands of titles a la carte, no subscription necessary. There's even multi-device integration across the Google ecosystem. And for a limited time, you get $10 off your first one over $10 by visiting g.co/play/kick. That's g.co/play/kick. Find your story with audiobooks on Google Play. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.